This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity for Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Well, hello there. Nice of you to stop by again if you're a regular listener. For all you newcomers, this is Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from atop the world in Northern Europe, Midwest of Sweden to be more precise. You can follow us on a regular basis, radio, TV programs, news, and so much more. RedIceCreations.com, our website. You'll have all the information right there. Today we have Mac Maloney with us, born in Boston, Massachusetts. He is the author of 40 sci-fi and adventure books. He graduated from Suffolk University in Boston with a degree in journalism and went on to graduate school at Emerson College, earning a degree in filmmaking. Mac joins us to talk about his new non-fiction book, UFOs in Wartime. Stay with us for the next 2 hours as we begin in the early record of human history and go all the way up to today following the UFO phenomena. Thank you for coming on Red Ice Radio, Mac. It's good to talk to you. How are you, and how was your Christmas, by the way, Mac?
Well, I'm doing pretty good, and thanks for having me. Christmas was actually pretty good. I live in Boston, Massachusetts, in the USA, and believe it or not, we haven't had any snow yet this winter. So everyone has their fingers crossed that it will stay like that, though I have a feeling it won't.
Well, same here, actually. We haven't had any decent snow. How was it early the last autumn, though, in 2011? Were you affected by this huge storm that ravaged the East Coast there?
Yes. Yep. We got that storm, and we live right on the coast of the Atlantic Ocean. So anything that comes up the coast, we usually get it. It's just you have to deal with these things when you live in New England, is the part of the U.S. that we live in.
That's right. We did a show about New England megalithic sites, by the way. Really interesting. Are you familiar with any of that? Considering
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. There's one in Salem, New Hampshire that we've gone to, and that's probably about a half hour's drive from where we live.
Wow, excellent. Really, really interesting. Obviously, we're here today to talk about your book, UFOs in Wartime, and we're going to go through some of the sightings that you detail in your book, going back into history and follow it up into modern times. And there is a specific focus, obviously, in and around World War II, and we'll talk about why that is a little bit later on as well. But first of all, why don't we just briefly, Mac, talk a little bit about your interest in this subject. I know that you're a nonfiction writer, primarily anyway, and this is your first one about UFOs, if I'm correct. And you have then primarily published novels before. How did this happen?
Well, you're right. I've been writing for about 20 years full time, and most of the books I've done have been novels, military adventure novels, and some science fiction novels thrown in. And but I've always had an interest in UFOs, even as a kid. And I had an interest as well in military history. My father was a veteran of World War II, and he was also he also liked to read about World War II. And so when I was growing up, there was a lot of these military history books around my house, and I used to read them as a kid, sometimes just look at the pictures. So I became interested in these two things, and I was having lunch with my editor a few years ago now, and I mentioned to him that the subject of UFOs came up, and I just mentioned to him a thought I had had right around the same time, that it just seemed that UFO sightings seemed to go up in times of war, just from things that I had read and heard and so on. And he said, you know, that might be a good idea for a book, but, you know, we'd have to do it as a nonfiction book. So we went through the process of, putting a proposal together and so on and so forth. And that was about 2.5 years ago. And, the book came out about a month ago.
There you go. How familiar were you with some of the research before? Had you read some of the other books? I mean, obviously, you talk about Jack Vallée in your book, and many other researchers as well. Are all familiar names to you?
If they weren't when I started, they are now, for sure. I mean, I knew Jerry Clark, I'd read a lot of his stuff, and I also had read Keith Chester's book, which was called Strange Company, which deals exclusively with the Foo Fighters. And while I was researching this book, I actually got to know those two guys, especially Keith, helped me out a lot in the research for the book, and then I kind of consulted with Jerry Clark. And so I wound up reading a lot of books that I had read as a kid, to tell you the truth, Donald Keyhoe's book and things like that. And then a lot of the new stuff, and of course, you can get a lot of UFO information online now, too. So there was no shortage of research to create the book from, let's say.
That's right. It's almost the other way around, right? You have to filter out some of the stuff because there's just so much out there, you know?
Yes, for sure. I mean, there's about 70 episodes in the book that we distilled down from, I'm going to say, maybe about 200 or so. We just figured that we would take, you know, the best of the best, and then there's some stories in there that were just too good not to put in. That's how we got it to the final number. But you're right. That's one good thing about UFO research in general is that there's just so much information out there now and so many different ways to get it.
That's right. And Keith Chester, by the way, he was with us all the way back in 2008 talking about Foo Fighters and also the aspect of these sightings during wartime. Very interesting. He also wrote the foreword to your book as well, of course. So he's a good friend.
Yeah,
of yours.
He's a good guy. He's primarily a filmmaker. He's an interesting guy, and he went and took on this project for the Foo Fighter book, Strange Company. Went down to Washington D.C., lives in Baltimore, and it went like right into the old reports from the USA Air Force in Europe and also the British Bomber Command, and really, really got right down and dirty with the stuff and revealed a lot of information about Foo Fighters that people had never heard before.
That's right. So why don't we talk about some of the cases and kind of begin at the beginning, of course. I was struggling myself to find out first here. Was it Alexander the Great first or Constantine? But obviously it was Alexander the Great first that had one of the early ones, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's one story that we came upon. The earliest story where we had UFOs in wartime comes from about 300 BC when Alexander the Great was in the middle of conquering, at the time, the known world. And there's an incident where he was crossing a strategic river, I believe it was in eastern Persia. And his army consisted of a lot of infantry, but also a lot of cavalry and war elephants. And as they were about to across this river, as the story goes, these five flying shields showed up over the army and began buzzing them, and it, to the point where they spooked the hussars and the war elephants, and they refused to cross the river. So here's a situation where, and it's a rare situation to tell you the truth, but where UFOs actually had were affecting the outcome of a military campaign, or at least delaying it. And then about 2 years later, he and his army were down in Lebanon. They were laying siege to the city of Tyre, which was actually a city that was built out in the harbor, out in a harbor. And his troops were building causeways to reach the city and attack it. And right at the as soon as they had finished these causeways, these shields showed up again, according to the story. And one of them blasted away one of the walls and allowed Alexander's troops to go in and take the city. So once again, for whatever reason, we have these two stories of UFOs and Alexander, one of them helping him win a battle, and one of them at least delaying another battle. So very interesting.
Very interesting indeed. These are things that are echoed in certain biblical scriptures even. There's weird stories here about intervention, almost, if we can put it that way, that these crafts, whatever they are, seem to also favor one side, at least in the early stories, when it comes to Alexander here, obviously, but also with Constantine and some of the biblical stories that I've heard, you know, shattering the gates of Jericho, for instance. That's another one, right?
Right, right. It's kind of odd because in the older stories, as you say, like the biblical stories, one almost in ancient history, the UFOs do seem to take certain sides. The Constantine story, which I can tell is happened in 300 AD or so, where Constantine the First was about to do battle with one of his rivals just outside Rome. And whoever won this battle was going to be the next emperor of Rome. So the night before the battle, or the day before the battle, Constantine and his army saw a UFO in the sky. It was shaped like a cross. And he had a number of seers that followed his army, and they told him that he should interpret this UFO sighting to mean that if his soldiers put crosses on their shields, that they would win the battle the next day, even though they were the underdogs, they were outnumbered. So he ordered his soldiers to do this, and they fought the battle the next day, and they won. And he became the next emperor of Rome. And one of the first things he did was make Christianity the official religion of Rome, because to him, the crosses were actually crucifixes that has been put on the shield. So, and that's why Christianity, well, became the official religion of Rome, but actually, you know, spread throughout Europe and around the world. So in an odd way, the reason Christianity is so widespread today could be due to a UFO sighting, which is, again, a very interesting scenario.
That's right. And even his motto, in this sign, you will conquer, in hoc signo vinces, it is the whole story right there, basically, of whatever he was that he saw in the sky. The question, obviously, I've always had is, how true are these stories? How accurate can we actually say that they are? Or is it possible that these are maybe not... Well, there could be fabrications in afterwards to try to imply that their missions were divinely inspired by a higher force. What do you think, Mac?
Well, who's to know, really? We would come upon when we decided the as I was saying before, when we were deciding what stories to put in the book, a number of them, especially in more modern times, do have a lot of documentation. But when we were talking about the ones that went way back, they came under the category of saying, if we wanted to advance this theory that UFOs show up a lot in wartime, what better way to start off the book than with these two very interesting stories about Alexander the Great and Constantine? So they kind of fell under the under the condition of, well, they're just too good not to put in the book, so we put them in the book. Whether how accurate they are, who's to say? But I always think that even though people might think that they're myths or whatever, something must have happened. So that's why we put them in the book.
That's right, and they definitely deserve attention, because as always, I think the further back in the record we go, the more, in one sense, interesting it gets. These days, of course, we're tainted with the movies and everything else, and people can have, in some cases, even an incentive maybe to try to create a mythology around an event or what have you. But way back, it seems a little bit different. And we have situations as biblical art. We have other things coming out, even in paintings from the Renaissance era. If we kind of move ahead a little bit in the chronology, if you will, that seems and appears to show UFOs. What are we to make of these, do you think?
Well, there's that famous story about over Nuremberg, I think it was, where the people woke up one day and saw what could only be described as a battle in the sky. They were describing these flaming red balls and these things that looked like cigar-shaped objects, which is an object that we hear mentioned over and over again throughout history as describing a certain kind of UFO, and these things shooting at each other in just this massive aerial battle that many people saw, so much so that it was reported in the newspapers back then. This can't be just something that was made up, because it just seems like there are a lot of witnesses. There's another strange story that we came upon having to do with the days of the Black Plague, where, most people now believe that the reason the Black Plague happened was that it was caused by a bacteria carried by fleas that were carried by rats. But at the same time, there are some writings that say that people would see a strange mist falling from the sky on a certain area of Europe, and at that time, people would fall sick from the plague, and also at that time, that these odd characters would show up wearing cloaks and carrying scythes and killing animals. And these people, we could call them almost like the first Men in Black, but they're actually the people, they're what we came to know as the Grim Reapers. So there's a lot of stories that happened in the Middle Ages that when you look at them from our perspective, it does seem like they was caused by some kind of UFO activity.
I mean, wow, what a huge piece of in human history if that turns out to be the case. The Black mm-hmm. Plague, we have something else, possibly from another world, or at least of an origin we don't know, creating these circumstances. We're talking about a mass die-off of humanity here. Wow.
Well, there was during that time, in and above the fact that the Black Plague was just going through Europe, there were a lot of strange things happening. People would see a lot of strange things in the sky. They would see the sky turn red on unusual occasions, bright red, like in the middle of the night. We saw reports of strange creatures were like, you know, washing up onto the beaches of France. And it was just like, it seemed like a lot of crazy things were going on at that time. And you know, and these people, these characters who showed up as the Grim Reapers is just like one more story. So, very bizarre, very bizarre time in human history. And, to think that UFOs might have been, you know, somehow responsible for it is just really kind of mind-blowing.
It is, really. And you have another interesting story. I've heard that one, too, before, about Columbus. Tell us that one.
Well, yeah, we came upon the story where Columbus was at the tail end of his voyage, and he and one of his navigators were on his ship, Santa Maria, one night, and saw this bright object in the sky that was moving. It would appear and disappear and appear and disappear, and they were more or less following it. And when night turned to day, when the morning came, they had discovered, well, San Salvador, and basically they had discovered America. So, again, an odd story that history was really made by Columbus following something that we would consider a UFO.
That's right. And before we then head into, well, World War One, and then primarily World War Two, and talk about that, there is another one that, and I haven't heard this one before, but George Washington apparently had some kind of encounter as well. Tell us about that.
Well, once again, one of these stories that, you know, we considered whether to put it in or not, it was just too good to leave out. We found some writings where it was said that when George Washington and the Continental Army, this was during the American Revolution, were at Valley Forge, and that's a place in Pennsylvania, and it was really the lowest part of the American Revolution. Things were not looking good for the American side, that they had made friends with a Native American tribe that they called the Greenskins. And these people gave them food and wood for their fires and so on, and also gave them what we would consider military intelligence on the British and Hessian troops that were in the area. Now, these Greenskins were said to live in a lodge that was shaped like a saucer, and like a large saucer, and was sometimes there and sometimes wasn't there. So that has led some people to believe that maybe this thing was some kind of flying saucer, and that these Greenskins were actually people who were occupants of the flying saucer.
Again, it might imply then help that in this case they actually took sides, so to speak, and this might have actually implied that this helped the Americans to win the Revolutionary War, correct?
It seems that way, yes.
Wow, interesting. And George Washington, of course, has had a lot of interesting the vision of George Washington. I don't know if that had anything to do with this specifically, but there's a lot to this guy of George Washington. A little bit later, I want to return to the city of Washington, of course, and talk about some of the famous sightings there. But before we dive into the World War then, I want to try to get to this question of why you think it is that we have so many sightings specifically during wartime. Do you think that there's simply more people, more trained personnel watching the skies during these time, or could it be that we actually have more UFOs out there, out and about, actually watching us during our, from their point of view, maybe petty armed conflicts? What do you think, Mike?
Well, when I started the book, my initial thought was exactly what you just said, especially in the 20th century, where the book really goes from, you know, after the run-up from these anecdotes from medieval times and so on, it really starts going in 1909 with the scare shifts and goes right up until the end of the First Gulf War. So most of the 20th century. And what I thought was that, well, yeah, because now we have airplanes in the mix and we have aerial warfare, therefore there's people flying around up in the sky, and there's more opportunities for people to see, you know, whatever UFOs are, and more people on the ground looking up in the sky, and like you just said, maybe possibly just more eyes looking up in the sky because of aircraft and so on. But then as I really kind of got into the research, it just seemed to be more than that. And I really came around to the conclusion that UFOs just seem to, you know, spike, sightings of UFOs seem to spike when we are at war or when we're preparing to go to war. And I really have come around to the idea that whatever they are looking in on us when great events are happening in human history. And in a strange way, there are, you know, there's no greater event than, you know, when we're killing each other in some worldwide war. I really think that they are looking at us, observing us. I'll frankly tell you what my theory is I'm not convinced that these things are extraterrestrial. I've come to believe that there's a good chance that they're actually time travelers from our future. And I'm not the first one to come upon this idea, but, you know, time travels from our future, coming back to see history as it's being made.
That's an interesting one. What if that's the case? Exactly. This would potentially make sense then, because the future us, if I can put it that way, would definitely be interested in trying to get an accurate description or a first-hand account, I guess, of what actually happened in history. So this would make perfect sense. And so much as we know, unfortunately, Mac, is being shaped by, our history is being shaped by war, you know?
Right. You know, it really is. And you know, the example that I can come up with and I've used before is that, and just jumping ahead to the Foo Fighters for a second, is that, you know, some Foo Fighters were described as these fantastic aerial machines. They were huge. They were long, cigar shaped, and people saw portholes in them and actually beings behind the portholes, and they could maneuver and speed up and slow down and do all these fantastic things. And you have to think, well, if these things are created by someone who has that kind of technology, that kind of futuristic, unbelievable technology, then why would they choose to ride 200 feet off the wing of a Lancaster bomber while it's bombing a German city in the middle of the night, if not just to see history literally as it's being made? You know, there was just so many instances like that, you know, it really got me thinking about this whole time traveler theory.
Well, because I think that's a really interesting theory. The only big question mark that I have around that one specifically is the difference that we seem to be getting of the crafts, if I can put it that way. They seem to go through an update almost. It doesn't mean, of course, that whoever's doing the time traveling actually is updating their own crafts by the means they're getting here. But in the early days, well, with the exception of Constantine's potential, you know, cross, we have the vision of Enoch, you know, with these circles or you know, spinning wheels in the sky. But a big one in the beginning, if I put it that way, 30s and a little bit earlier, is a cigar kind of shaped crafts. And one of these is, you brought this up, the scare ships, England. Tell us about that and the cigar shaped ones.
Well, the scare ships story it's one of my favorite chapters in the book. In 1909, people in England started seeing these large cigar shaped objects. Actually, they look pretty much like zeppelins flying overhead at night in the East Anglia section of the UK at the beginning of this. And people at first thought that they were German Zeppelins, and because back in 1909 it was almost like a foregone conclusion that World War One was going to start and that Germany and England were going to be at war, just the political situation around that time. So people thought that they were German Zeppelins come to spy on England while preparing to go to war with England. But as it turned out, even though the Germans had Zeppelins at that time, they didn't have any military Zeppelins, and they didn't have any Zeppelins that could make the 700-mile round trip from Germany to England, and they certainly couldn't do it at night. So exactly what people were seeing, you know, no one ever really figured out. They would once again see these huge things that looked like Zeppelins, but they were going very fast. Some of them were clocked at going more than 200 miles an hour. And these days, even our most modern blimps can't make over like 50 or 60 miles an hour. They were seen with huge spotlights hanging from underneath them, shining beams down on the ground. And certainly if you're sent to go spy on someone, you don't do it with huge spotlights attracting attention to yourself in the middle of the night. And more than one of these things were seen at night. In fact, they were seen as far away as Northern Ireland. They were seen over London all during 1909. Plus, there had been a previous airship scare over the United States in 1897, I believe it was. So no one ever figured out what these things were. They kind of petered out, and then the war started in 1914, and real Zeppelins started showing up over England and bombing England. But as to what the scare ships were, no one ever really figured it out. Really a big mystery.
What about the black ops weapons development aspect here? The theories that an underground element within society, or specifically the military, I guess, always have kind of possessed technology that is 50 to 100 years ahead of the rest of us. This, could that explain then that why we're getting these in the beginning cigar-shaped ones, which meaning they actually might have been fast-traveling zeppelins, but this seems to advance the further, in the future we go?
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a certain element of that, and I was surprised to find that, but there's a certain element of that type of thing running through the book, because we go from the scare ships and then to the ghost flyers and then to the ghost rockets, and it does seem like on certain occasions people do see things that technology that seems either a little bit or more than a little ahead of its time. Once again, people seeing Zeppelin-shaped objects over England in 1909 is very strange, almost impossible. But people seeing Zeppelin-shaped objects over England in 1915 isn't so
odd. That's right, yeah.
People seeing these very strange airplanes over Sweden in 1933 is very odd. But if there were airplanes like that, maybe if it happened 15 years later, not as odd. So, yeah, that's another thing. I find that whole idea fascinating, that there are certain circumstances where people see, as I said before, technology that just seems ahead of its time. But once again, there's just no real explanation for that.
That's right. We've talked quite extensively with other guests, and when I get your take on this, of course, about the Scandinavian or Swedish connection here to this, obviously, because first we have the ghost flyers, and then we have the ghost rockets. They're separated by, 10 years or so, and there's a little bit difference to them as well. Break it down for us, if you
right. Well, the ghost flyers first started showing up at the end of 1933 and then into 1934. And they were first seen over part of Sweden, which, I understand is pronounced Västerbotten.
Västerbotten, yes. That's
okay,
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
and that's in the northern part of Sweden, I'm assuming?
That's right, yep. Yeah.
Well, people just in the end of 1933 and 1934 started seeing these very odd airplanes. They were gigantic. They had 8 engines on them. They had a weird tail section. It was like a twin boom tail section, similar to a P-38 fighter from World War II. And they, too, had searchlights on the bottom of their fuselages that they would beam down to the ground. So during 33 and 34, these things started showing up first over that region of Sweden, and then over Norway and Finland as well. And lots of people saw them. There were more than one, because people saw 2 or 3 of them at a time flying in formation. They were spotted in different parts of Scandinavia simultaneously. They were known to do very strange things. Like, for instance, they were known to circle towns and villages endlessly all night long. And I'm assuming that time of year that it's dark most of the time.
Yeah.
And with their searchlights ablaze, just endlessly going around cities, small towns, villages, railroad stations, or mountains. And the other thing about that is, these things would be seen doing this for 8 or 9 hours at a time. And even these days, there are very few airplanes that can fly for 8 or 9 hours at a time without refueling. And certainly back in 1933-34, it was impossible for an airplane to stay up that long, but these things were. And they also made a lot of noise and caused a lot of commotion and so on. So people thought, what could these things be, And theory was that they could be German aircraft, because the Nazis had just taken over in Germany. But that the Germans might have had this secret aircraft carrier hidden up in the Arctic somewhere. But that theory just doesn't hold water, because you would have to have, first of all, even if you had a modern aircraft carrier these days, to launch a couple dozen airplanes every night after night, have them fly over this, really rugged territory in really bad weather conditions, that would be a challenge today. And with the modern super aircraft carrier, as I said, to do it way back then, it would be almost impossible. Plus, the Germans never had an aircraft carrier. Plus, if they were launching it from some ship or something, that ship would have to come back to Germany at some point and refuel and so on, and there would be a break in the sightings of these things, and there never was such a break. And plus, when they finally went away at the end of 1934, no one ever came forward. No one has ever came forward to say, I was one of the ghost flyers. I was flying one of these planes. We were doing this for this reason, that reason. They just simply disappeared. So, no one has ever figured out what these things were. And as I say, it's that and the Skiffs are actually the two favorite chapters of mine in the book. Very odd story.
It is a very odd story. And, I mean, if it was Germans, as you said, they would have to, you know, take off someone from their northern part. And if they had some kind of carrier, that means that they were up in the most northern part of the Gulf of Botnia, which is right between Sweden and Finland. And I don't know what they would be doing there. And more understandably, mm-hmm. perhaps if they were up around the northern tip of Norway and maybe, you know, looking for something up in the Arctic, maybe, potentially. Mm-hmm. We know that they had interests in the Poles and all this, the Nazis. But what do you, if it's not them, what do you think it was? And what, I mean, almost like they were looking for something then, if they were in the manner they were flying around. What were they looking for, do you think?
Right. I mean, it's a good question, you know. I mean, it's a mystery. If it was, you know, there's just no way with the Germans because, you know, or the Russians, because at some point, as I said before, someone would come forward, you know, as time went on and reveal their you know, participation in this. Or, you know, we would have found after Germany was defeated, we would have found, you know, the place or the ship or the manufacturing facility that made these odd airplanes, you know, but none of that stuff was ever found. So, you know, what were they? I don't know. What could they have possibly been looking for night after night? You know, sometimes dozens of these things. It's a mystery, and it gets back to that, what you had mentioned before. It's almost like we're looking at or something or somebody, you know, is somehow caught in our time, our existence, and it's almost like a mistake that they're here. And they're using this technology that just seems a little out of time. I don't know. It's baffling. You know, it's fun to think about what theories could explain this, but, you know, at the end of the day, it's almost like there's no explanation at all.
It's a big mystery. It's a huge one, and one that people have been obviously trying to crack, if you will, for years now. Mm-hmm. So many researchers have been looking into these things. And if we move ahead down a little bit too, I want to return a little bit to, I want to get your take on the Foo Fighters as well, but if we stay in Scandinavia, then, if you will, up here in Sweden, and go forward about 10 years, a little bit more, we have the Ghost rockets, very similar, mm-hmm. but they're kind of an updated version of them, if you know what I mean.
Right. Yeah, it was 1946 in February of 1946. Now, World War II is over, the Foo Fighters have disappeared, and all of a sudden, people start seeing these rockets going over Sweden, all of Sweden. And in fact, a lot of them were spotted going over Stockholm. And they were described as, there was many descriptions, but the description that most people agree on were a kind of rocket-shaped, tube-shaped rocket, sometimes having wings, sometimes not having wings, but, you know, obviously showing, you know, some kind of motor or some kind of rocket thrust coming out of the back of it. Sometimes they made noise and sometimes they didn't. And there were just, you know, dozens and dozens of these things spotted. And it got to the point where, and we get into the research of this a little bit, where the Swedish government secretly went to the British government and asked them for air defense radar just to see if these things could be picked up in radar. So the British gave them some radar, and sure enough, as soon as this radar was installed, it turns out, you know, very shortly after that, that up to 200 of these Ghost rockets were spotted on radar. So now no one knows exactly what they are. The Swedish government and the U.S. military got together, and the U.S. military sent two somewhat famous generals over to Sweden secretly. One of them was Jimmy Doolittle, who was the hero of the 30 Seconds Over Tokyo raid, a very famous World War II story. And they met with Swedish military officials, and they tried to get together to figure out, put their heads together to figure out where these Ghost rockets were coming from. And the first theory was that they were coming from a place called Peenemünde, which was in Germany. Mm-hmm. And it was the Nazis' launching base. It was actually their manufacturing facility and test launching place for the V-1 and V-2 rockets that the Nazis had during the war. And at first, a lot of people thought that must be the case and that the Russians had taken over this missile base and had revived the Germans' V-1, at least the V-1 buzz bomb missile program, and that they were shooting these things over Sweden. Well, you know, for what reason they would do this, no one really understood, but Peenemünde seemed to be the most likely place. Well, anyway, they looked into that, and they found out that Peenemünde, for the most part, had been destroyed by retreating German troops at the very end of the war. And what was left there, the Russians basically packed up and moved to Poland. Plus, we have to remember that, you know, on a good day, the Nazis could shoot off about a dozen V-1 rockets. Well, people were seeing dozens of ghost rockets over Sweden. So Peenemünde was then basically nixed out as far as, you know, the cipher where these missiles were coming from. So then they were left with no explanation for them at all. And finally, the Swedish military finally came to the conclusion, and they said this to the U.S. military representatives in documents that came out later. They really thought that this was technology that they had no idea where it was from. It did not seem to be earthly technology. So the Swedish military was actually the first military to come out to think that these things were, you know, not of this earth, let's say. Very odd. I mean, I keep saying that because all the stories in the book are kind of odd, but, yeah, you know, this one is like, you know, really, really odd. So how we end that chapter is actually with a piece of a interview that a Swedish defense minister at the time, he was a Swedish defense minister in the 40s. He gave this interview in the 80s, and he said, from everything he saw, and there were instances where Swedish Air Force planes would track these things and fly alongside them. So they had really good looks at these things. And this defense minister said, from everything he saw and everything he heard, his only conclusion is that cruise missiles were flying over Sweden in 1946. But as he asked, who had cruise missile technology in 1946?
Yeah, and where were they going?
Where were they going?
Exactly. It's really interesting. There is some photographic evidence for this as well, some images that were taken. We also have this other story connected to it with something crashing into the a lake as well. I don't know if you heard about that one. We talked about the UFO Sweden representative Klaus Swan about that a while back. And this is an interesting one as well. It's connected to it. Did you ever hear about that?
Right. And we mentioned that a little bit in the book where it went into a lake. People saw it go into this lake, and a ghost rocket crashed into a lake. And the Swedish military was on it pretty quickly. And they sectioned off the lake, and they went into the lake with skin divers and found nothing. So, I mean, their only conclusion was that the rocket crashed into the lake and then somehow disappeared. They never found any wreckage or anything at the bottom of the lake, which just makes the mystery even more mysterious.
That's right. It's there is a common, you know, connection to UFOs, and some of them seems to be able to actually go in and out of water as well. Any other of those cases in the book?
Yep. There's a few cases that we take from World War II where pilots saw, in one case, a Royal Australian Air Force pilot was flying around New Guinea, I believe, in World War II, and this craft came up right beside him and flew alongside him, and then just suddenly kind of dove into the water and just disappeared beneath the waves. And then towards the end of the war, there's a incident where a U.S. Army ship was delivering supplies to bases in Alaska, and there was 14 people on the ship, and they saw this huge sphere come right out of the ocean, and then it circled their ship twice and then took off at high speed to the south. And these people were so impressed by this, let's say, and probably frightened by it, that they signed affidavits that this in fact had happened. And you know, there were many other cases. We don't go into them in the book, but anyone who has even a passing interest in UFOs knows that there are many cases of what they call USOs. There was cases off of Nova Scotia back in the 60s where it seemed like the Canadian and the U.S. Navy had a USO trapped in a bay up there, and it finally did get away. So there's a lot of people who the theory is that UFOs actually come from, you know, somewhere at the bottom of the ocean, and let's face it, there's a lot of places to hide down there.
There sure is, exactly. There's a lot of areas around the planet that isn't too populated by human beings, and it seems to be, obviously, the further up north or the further south you get, these seems to be areas that are hot spots among, you know, many other sites, of course, around the world. But let's talk a little bit here briefly about the Foo Fighter aspect here then before we take a little break here in a little while. I also obviously want to let people know what websites to go to, how to get a copy of the book, etc. We'll talk about that in a little while here. But the Foo Fighters, then, we always seem to go to the Nazis to explain away a lot of the technology that seems to be ahead of its time. But in the case of the Foo Fighters, as far as I know, the Nazi didn't take this, claim that it was theirs, obviously. They were equally puzzled by this phenomena as the Allies were, correct, Mac?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the short version of the Foo Fighters was, as soon as the British Bomber Command started bombing Germany at the beginning of World War II, their bomber crews were coming back to their bases and reporting that they were being followed by these strange aerial machines. Some of them were described as balls of light. Some of them were described as rocket-shaped, but others were described as what we were talking about earlier, your basic flying saucer-shaped and also your cigar-shaped objects. And this continued throughout the early part of the war, and then when the American Air Force finally arrived in UK and started bombing Germany during the day, the British would bomb Germany at night and the Americans would bomb during the day, American crews started seeing these things too. And the crews would come back and they would be debriefed on their missions, and then they would tell their debriefing officers, the intelligence officers, about these things, and it really put the intelligence officers in a precarious spot, as Keith Chester points out in his book, Strange Company, because, first of all, what you have to remember is that the main goal of the British and the Americans at this point was to basically bombard Germany into submission and get the war over as quickly as possible. They didn't have the time or the resources to look into what these strange things were. So there was kind of a mind think that, well, they must be German secret weapons. And once we win the war, if we win the war, we'll just find out what these things are. But what happened was, when the war was over, they basically said to the Germans, what were these things? And the Germans says, we saw them too. We thought they were your secret weapons.
Yeah, that's right.
and once again, here you have, a mystery that has never been solved. A lot of people I know these days, have written books about saying that these were actually Nazi super weapons and so on and so forth, which is fine. I think it's good to get into all aspects of UFO research. But as we go into our book, what we say is, if it was true that the Nazis were able to have these like fantastic flying machines that were described, number one, why is there no cases where the Foo Fighters ever fired on any of our airplanes, British or American? Why didn't they do that if they were Nazi aircraft, super weapons? Why didn't they, shoot at our troops in the ground? When we finally got into Germany after the war, no facility was ever found that could make these fantastic craft. I mean, if they were German manufactured, there would have had to have been a huge facility hidden away someplace with hundreds of people and scientists and resources, and none of that was ever found. And finally, if the Germans had this kind of fantastic weaponry, why did they lose the war? So, the whole idea that they were Nazi super weapons just really doesn't hold water, in my opinion.
What about the V-2 for a moment then? Because I looking at a bit of Peenemünde here, the base, obviously some of the initial, work was done here on the V-2 rockets. A lot of things seem to indicate, at least, that they were right on the cusp of developing something like this. And as, many of our listeners will know, this is eventually through Wernher von Braun, other Nazis that went over to the States, finished up on this work, of course, which eventually led to the success, if you will, then, of the Apollo program. So they're in this area. They're right there, if you will.
Right, and that's true. But, there's a vast difference between the descriptions of what Foo Fighters could do and what was seen doing and what a V-2 could do. A V-2, it was really ahead of its time, there's no doubt about it, but V-2 is basically a ballistic missile where, it's liquid-fueled, and you basically light the fuse, and this thing goes up in a high trajectory, and then the engine burns out of its fuel, and they're able to steer it so when it's on its descent, basically crashing, it would hit some kind of a target. Not very accurately. There were more terror weapons than anything else. So even though it was an advanced rocketry for the time, it was no way was what it could do similar to what Foo Fighters were reported doing. That was just these fantastic crafts maneuvering like crazy and going at speeds, 10,000, 11,000, 15,000 miles an hour, there's just a wide gap in between what the two things we're seeing doing, let's say, what their capabilities were.
It's a really interesting story. That, again, then the book is called UFOs in Wartime. It's a fascinating compilation here of some of the most interesting and as you pointed out, weird cases and sightings here during war and wartime. And a little bit later here, I want to try to get to this aspect of you know, why it seems to be so heavily, you know, around World War II, and then the further away we come from that, it seems to be more and more difficult to kind of pin down what actually is going on. We have, of course, new weapons technologies ourselves. We have, you know, drones now, and we have other weird things flying around, stealth technology. So it's very difficult. But we'll try to get to this question here a little bit later then, Mac. But in the meantime here, before we take a little break here, please give out your website so people know where to go to pick up copies of your book and read more about your work, of course.
Okay, well, the best place to go would be macmaloney.com. And there's a lot of information there on where to pick up the book. And also there's a link there to our new website, which is called UFOsinwartime.com. The book is sold, well, in the U.S., it's published by Penguin Books, so it's sold everywhere in the U.S. at every bookstore. But the best place for people actually to buy it would be on Amazon.com. So any one of those places, Amazon.com or MacMaloney.com, would be the place to go to order the book.
That's right, MacMaloney.com. And I was, before the show as well, looked into the new website that UFOs in Wartime. Looks great, by the way, and there's a good, really good run-through, obviously, of some of the chapters and some of the details that we've been talking about right there on the site as well. It looks great, by the way, the site there.
Great. Thanks very much. I appreciate that.
Excellent. So check out the websites, and we'll carry on here. We'll take a short break right now, but we'll carry on in the next segment. So stay with us, Mac. We'll be right back with more. In the second hour, we begin talking about UFOs seen on radar over Washington, D.C., and the cover-up attempts of these and other sightings. We explore various sightings in history from the Battle of Los Angeles to World War II with the Foo Fighters and Roswell. Maloney talks about the flood of sightings in the USA in the 40s and how it connects to nuclear weapons testing and ICBM sites. He also tells us why he doesn't believe the Roswell crash was an alien craft. Then we get into the strange story in his book, which took place after the first Gulf War in Iraq, called Operation Desert Shield. We discuss the theory of time-traveling humans operating UFOs versus the alien theory. Later, Mac tells us information he received off the record while researching this book. This is regarding fighter jet patrols that took place primarily after 9/11 and the increase of UFO sightings. We end questioning the appearance of UFOs in current and potential upcoming wars. Go to our members area on redicecreations.com. Log in and click on the second hour with Mac Maloney, or of course any other previous programs going all the way back to 2006. As a member, you can also subscribe to our RSS feeds with both hours or listen using our iPhone app. If you're not a member and want to get full access to our radio program dedicated to bringing you some of the most fascinating and important information, click on subscribe to read more about becoming a member. We have a few different options for you right there. It's quick and easy. Try us out for 3 months. It's only €5 per month. And we spare you from commercial breaks. We don't have any corporate sponsors. We are 100% independent, dedicated to finding answers and letting the information lead us where it may. We have some great programs coming up next on Red Ice Radio. Troy McLaughlin on the Saturn Death Cult, a two-part program. Then we have Jeff Hilling, Carl Munk, Bob Frisell, Anthony Peak, Asharia S., Mark Passio, Dr. Robert Verkirk, Joseph Atville, Sonia Barrett, Robert Bavall, and Håkan Blomqvist on the very strange and intriguing contact story of Richard Höglund. This is not Richard Hoagland, people. Richard Höglund, one of the few reported alien contact stories coming out of Sweden. Very interesting. Okay, but next up, we have hour two of UFOs in Wartime with Mac Maloney. Stay tuned.